All right, welcome everyone to the RSP cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio, and joining me today is Gene Clemens. Gene Clemens is a writer for Football Game Plan. He's an analyst there. He's also has his own podcast, Offensive Interference Podcast, which is a terrific one that I would recommend for you to check out. And, you know, Gene does a lot of fine work. He's someone who, you know, is also a, you know, he's a former college player, college wide receiver at Pittsburgh State. And he is also an offensive coordinator at Lakeside High School, which isn't far from where I grew up. So, Gene, it's always a pleasure to have you on. You and I have done some work in the past, and it's always just nice to have you come back so we can talk shop.
Yes, sir. It's fantastic to be on with you again. I just want to make one correction. It's Fitchburg State. Pittsburgh State. I was a wide receiver at. I played there for 2 years. I don't want any Pittsburgh State people coming out like, we don't know who he is, you know. Pittsburgh State for 2 years, and then I finished up at tight end at Arkansas Tech University in Russellville, Arkansas. So, yeah, definitely no disrespect to Pittsburgh State. I just didn't want anybody coming from my head on social media.
Yeah, exactly. Because I misidentify a number of a player while I'm, you know, the main point I'm trying to make is about a concept, and people are telling me that I don't know football because I misidentified Alex Collins' number with Javorius Allen's. So
yeah,
I understand,
which is ridiculous.
Right, exactly. But you know, I mean, you got all kinds of people on social media. So today, I mean, we're going to focus on a number of things. I mean, I thought, you know, it'd be fun. You and I watched some Baker Mayfield tape about 3 years ago and did a pretty cool critical review of his game. So I thought it would be fun that we could talk about him a little bit. We could talk about some college players that you've had your eye on that you feel like more people should know about. Talk a little bit about the NFL game and then finish this up with a debate about Nick Chubb, because that's kind of how we decided to get together, for a conversation, because we were on social media and, you know, we'll kind of preview it as saying, you know, Gene's on, everyone knows kind of that I love Nick Chubb's game, and Gene feels like he's a talented player, but he's more just a guy in the NFL, if I'm characterizing that right. And we'll definitely get into that a little bit more and delve that out into detail. But let's just lead off with Baker Mayfield as kind of a revisit. What have you seen from him thus far? How does that compare to what you saw of him when he was at Oklahoma and then before that, you know, at A&M? And, you know, what do you feel like you need to see more of to feel one way or the other about him over the course of time?
Well, quite honestly, I think that what I've seen from Baker Mayfield is exactly what I expected to see. When we spoke about Baker Mayfield a few years ago, and I'm willing to admit that he improved in time from when we broke him down that last year, a couple years ago when he was at Oklahoma, till he finished his career at Oklahoma. But his game, a lot of people were extrapolating his game to the NFL as if he was going to be Drew Brees, with more athleticism, or, you know, he was going to be, you know, Brett Favre. And I never felt as if he would be on that level. I thought of his accuracy was inflated by the fact that the scheme he played in allowed a lot of wide receivers to be running open. I didn't think he threw people open very often. I didn't think he had to, so it wasn't necessarily a knock on him. It was just more like, he's not doing this. Like, this doesn't happen in the NFL. People don't end up, you know, butt naked in the NFL running wide open unless you're New Orleans and Drew Brees is about to break a record. So what I saw from him in college, I thought when I looked at it from the NFL perspective that you would see the completion percentage drop. You would see him not be able to escape as easily as he was able to escape in college. And I think that that's bared out over the course of these games that he's played. You see a lot more turnovers. You see a lot lower completion percentage than I think some people thought he would have. You don't see him being able to break off large chunks of runs on a whim. I think everybody jumped to conclusion that he was the next great off of that second half of football when he replaced an injured Tyrod Taylor. And in my opinion, that was a product of a team not preparing for him, an offensive coaching staff that did a great job of play calling in the second half, which they didn't do in the first half. And once that newness wore off and people said, okay, let's prepare for him, you started to see the warts immediately. It doesn't mean that he can't get by that. But for me, I look at him and I look at his ceiling and I don't see much more than your average NFL starting quarterback, which isn't a bad thing, but it's definitely not, oh, I should have taken him with the number one overall pick type of thing.
Yeah, it's an interesting one for me too, because the guy I kind of compared him to when people ask for a comparison is, I think his upside is more on what Jeff Garcia did really well. Like if Jeff Garcia was a Pro Bowl caliber player for certain seasons, and you know, he's a guy that can buy time and he can be decisive and be accurate enough to do a good job for you. And I think that I'm with you on that level, because I see a guy who on the one hand, I like that he's made some quick decisions. He's been able to, you know, identify where he wants to go, and he's been able to make some throws that have been in the tighter windows and shown that confidence and quick decision-making. But yeah, I mean, I don't see him scrambling around like Patrick Mahomes when Patrick Mahomes has to, and, you know, making ridiculous throws. I didn't think he was a ridiculous arm talent either. In terms of Baker Mayfield being a great arm talent, I like to see that he actually was able to throw a deep post, because I didn't see him do a lot of that at Oklahoma. But I'm still, you know, what's interesting to me is I hear a lot of people talk about it and they're like, well, wait till David Njoku, you know, really starts to develop and become a great player, and wait till the, you know, Hugh Jackson is out, and wait till they get some wide receivers. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, that's a lot of things to count on that we're not sure yet whether that's all going to happen and whether all those things are the right decisions, you know, that people are making on that. So I look at this and I think the Browns have played a little better offensively, in terms of just the overall result. And I think that Mayfield has done some good things with that, but I'm kind of with you where I'm not ready to crown him the future stud quarterback or even a future, you know, top franchise quarterback. I think he's had a pretty good month with some ups and downs, and I'm just waiting to see how the rest of this team develops and how he can work with that talent, and how also defenses will continue to try and play him. Can they continue to squeeze that pocket tight and start to challenge him a little bit more man to man, where he's going to have to make some other tight window throws off second and third reads, you know, against tight man coverage.
Yeah, and I think I think it's really interesting when you talk about some of the wait for that he has received. And I think that this is something that happens a lot in pro football when people want to cape for a certain talent. They tend to blame everybody else. For years, we've seen everybody else blamed for Andrew Luck just being an okay quarterback. We've seen everybody else blamed in situations where Eli Manning has not been good. But My point is that what happened to the quarterback elevating these other positions? If you look at the Browns receiving core, right, and Antonio Callaway, forget the marijuana or whatever it is. Like, I don't care about that type of stuff. Is he a football player? Is he not a football player? That guy, if he didn't have quote unquote character issues, would have been a top 20 pick. He's playing for the Browns. You had Josh Gordon. You didn't want to just let him play. You had your finger on him, your thumb on him so much that eventually you had to get rid of him. He steps in. He's already catching touchdown passes for New England. You've got Njoku, but what are they waiting for him to develop into? Because the last time I checked, he came out as a willing and able pass catcher. That's what you want him to be. He doesn't block worth a darn, in my opinion, which is why I don't even consider him to be a legitimate tight end. He's an H for me. So, like, what are you expecting him to turn into beyond what he is right now? Everybody can scheme when he comes in that it's probably a pass because he's not blocking anyone. Besides all that, you have a guy like Tyrod Taylor, who in week one and week two had a kicker kill a game for him, two games he should have won. The Browns would have been sitting at 2-0 after those two games. Everybody blamed Tyrod. You get Tyrod out. Baker Mayfield comes in. He's thrown more picks in just his time, or had more turnovers in just his time being in, than Tyrod Taylor has had in a complete season. And yet, everybody else is to blame. So I look at things and I'm like, look, I'm going to give you credit when you deserve credit. I'm going to give you the blame when you deserve the blame. I'm not going to delegate the blame other places because you're quote unquote a rookie. Even though just a couple months ago, people were saying you're the most prepared rookie to come in and play and be successful right now. I think he's done some good things, but I've also seen the inconsistencies that make me worry when I keep hearing people try to proclaim him as the next great.
Where would you parse out, say, you know, I've heard two different types of analysis. I mean, and some of those I've even, you know, some things I've seen myself is where Tyrod Taylor didn't commit the turnovers. What we did see is Tyrod Taylor leave the pocket at times and buy more time and then ended up having to throw the ball away. And he's not making bad plays. You know, whereas but at the same time, I've noticed a difference in terms of Baker Mayfield when he got in was pretty quick with, locating an open man and finding some open players. How much of that do you feel was scheme and what they were doing different than what they were doing with Taylor?
Well, I personally think that the scheme is completely different when Baker Mayfield in the game than with Tyrod in. And I'll say this, Baker Mayfield has a little bit more decisiveness in him by nature, but he's held the ball to his detriment in some games that have been a result of some bad plays. The problem with Tyrod Taylor, and I think this is why people are always so willing to jump off his bandwagon, is he isn't always willing to pull the trigger.
Right.
And I think that whether it's hold the ball too long in the pocket or try to escape the pocket, you know, extend the play, sometimes you just want him to pull the trigger. And obviously that has resulted in him having fewer turnovers, but it's also resulted in him being sacked more. It's resulted in him not having the production numbers that some other quarterbacks have. With Baker Mayfield, although he's willing to pull the trigger sometimes, I think that decisiveness gets him in trouble because sometimes he pulls the trigger and, you know, who he's shooting at, he shouldn't be shooting at. And so it's, you know, it's a catch-22, it's a double-edged sword. I think it's just whatever you desire as an offensive coordinator out of your quarterback. I think that the marriage with Tyrod in Cleveland with Hugh Jackson would have been a great marriage. But the moment Hugh Jackson was no longer in charge of that offense, that was not going to be an offense for Tyrod Taylor. And I think that, you know, in that case, it would have probably been a better idea to start Baker Mayfield from the beginning, because I think the offensive coordinator, Todd Haley, was never sold on Tyrod Taylor. And therefore, him not being sold subconsciously makes a worse game plan or play calling for a player that you're not sold on, if that makes any sense.
Sure. So what would you do? What would you ideally want to see Tyrod Taylor in a, what type of game plan or what type of things would you like to see a team do with Tyrod Taylor to maximize his talents in ways that Cleveland didn't?
I think Cleveland didn't take full advantage of the short passing game, the catch and throws, get him comfortable. I think there wasn't enough play action in terms of him being able to roll out. I don't think that players took advantage of the times when he actually did make those down the field throws. There were a couple of drops on deep balls where he took shots and he didn't connect, or where it seemed like receivers didn't, you know, run it out, or flat out drops. I one thing really stuck out to me is when Baker Mayfield got in the second half of the first game that he played, and they did that, you know, handoff throwback to him, and I was like, where were those types of plays with Tyrod in the game, who is a more dynamic athlete than Baker Mayfield is? Like, where were those types of plays? Like, why were there all of these zone read plays and things? That's not where Tyrod Taylor has ever been at his best. That's a misconception, even from college. When Tyrod Taylor had a lot of success running the ball, wasn't when it was designed quarterback runs. It was really more when things broke down and he decided to use his athleticism. This idea that Tyrod Taylor is somehow a zone read, RPO kind of quarterback is just inaccurate. Like, he's a manager.
And see, what was interesting to me is I was projecting that if the team was going to stick with Taylor all year, that I would have thought they would do more. If they were going to move him, it would be more off of, you know, him under center, mm-hmm. and doing play action, just play action fakes with boots, you know, boots, with a fine rollout.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I was expecting, because then if you want to use the threat of his legs, get him moving to the outside to put pressure on the defense where he's outside the pocket already, but he's also in a position to be able to have, you know, receivers flooding an area of the field, and he can make the appropriate read, you know, as they're flooding different ranges of that zone, you know. And I was kind of surprised when I saw a lot of that zone read. You know, I thought that they would probably do a little bit more, especially with a running game with some powerful backs to it, that I thought they'd give those guys a chance to run downhill and work with them from a, you know, from an eye or a single back set, and use Taylor in a fashion that sometimes we saw in Buffalo, you know, and where it was worthwhile. So, yeah, I was kind of surprised by it.
I would say this. Think about this from Todd Haley's perspective. If you inherit a quarterback that you don't believe in, and that everybody tells you takes care of the ball, but and this is the inaccurate analysis of Tyrod Taylor, makes more plays with his legs.
Nah.
If that's what you're thinking about a quarterback, what are you going to do? You're going to put in plays that lend itself to a quarterback who makes more plays with his legs. And so therefore you go to all of the normal misconception offensive game plans. Well, we're going to run zone read. We're going to run RPOs. We're going to do that type of stuff. Well, the reason why they had to run some zone read concepts in Buffalo is because Shady McCoy is better in a zone scheme where he has an opportunity to – you don't have zone backs in Buffalo. You have gap scheme. You have man scheme backs in Buffalo. Yeah. I mean, in Cleveland, excuse me. And so you have gap scheme, man scheme backs, and you're trying to run zone reads. So you're not helping out the running back, and you're not helping out the quarterback, because that's not really what he does best. And so,
yeah.
And like, I'm sorry. So for me, Todd Haley just, it wasn't like, it wasn't a match because he never truly believed in that quarterback. And so once he got Baker in, all of a sudden now a quarterback that he believes in or a quarterback that fits more of what he's looking for, okay, now let's go. Let's put in this stuff that I really know how to do well, that I'm really good at.
Yeah. And if you don't think, you know, it's interesting because, you know, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, you know, well, I'm skeptical of, you know, of that type of argument with the way teams are, then, you know, I would submit to you a few things, is that this has happened before. And a lot of offensive, you know, a lot of quarterback coaches who work with offensive talents in the NFL have talked about how, you know, oftentimes that coaches stick to a certain scheme that they like, regardless of whether the players match it. And also, we've seen instances in the past, a good one that was explained to me by the Broncos former GM, and I can't remember his name right now, but he was the GM with Mike Shanahan in Denver when they had Jake Plummer, and Jake Plummer had a Pro Bowl season and took them to the AFC Championship game against the Patriots. Or I think it was against the Steelers. I don't remember whether it was. I think it was against the Patriots, and threw multiple interceptions in that game. And what I was told by that GM, who was in, you know, who was still in when they drafted Cutler, was that Mike Shanahan didn't want Jake Plummer anymore, even though Jake Plummer had the locker room, had a big year, was productive. Shanahan was pretty much, I'm through. I want Matt Leinart, and that's who I want as my quarterback. And then they during, you know, pre-draft process, they decided that if Leinart wasn't going to be available, that they could all agree on Cutler. And, you know, if you go and look at the tape that next year, the best play, or the year before, the best play that Jake Plummer had were a series of plays where they did the bootleg play action. And oftentimes he could hit, you know, deep crossers or a deep post off of that. And he was fantastic on that play. And it was some of his most, you know, his most productive big plays came from these types of looks. And Mike Shanahan took those plays out of the playbook the final year that Jake Plummer started, and he did not run a single one of those plays for Jake Plummer. And they ended up benching Jake Plummer after going about 7-6 rather than being as good as they were projected to be, and saying we needed to go in a different direction. And they went with Jay Cutler, and they ran those plays with Jake Cutler. You know, so, and Jake Plummer retired at the end of the year, you know, and, you know, so you see these types of dysfunctional things, they occur. And it's, you know, it's not just, you know, some sort of conspiracy theory about, you know, how things are. That stuff actually does go down. So,
yes. And you've actually seen it, and people have probably seen it and not even realized what they were looking at when they see it. I go back to the Rob Johnson, Doug Flutie fiasco, where clearly people were not sold on Flutie. They didn't want to see him have success because that meant that they would have probably been forced by fans and whomever else to go with that guy. So you put a Rob Johnson in there who just, you know, used the bathroom all down his leg, and the rest is history. Even go to the college game. Look at the Alabama situation last year, yes, with offensive coordinator Brian Daboll, who did not believe in Jalen Hurts as a quarterback. And I know he didn't believe in him as a quarterback because you can see it in the play calling just in the national championship game. You don't even have to go back and look at the horrible play calling all throughout the season. But just look at the play calling in the national championship game in the first half. It was run. It was quarterback design run. It was third and whatever. Okay, throw the ball. That's what the offense was in the first half. Change that to the second half. First play out the gate's a pass play. And it's not like some crazy pass play. It's a simple, just get the ball out into a receiver, let him throw the ball. Like, to me, it said everything about what Dave wanted to do all year, which was go with Tua over Jalen Hurts. And again, when I talk about this type of stuff, it has nothing to do with the other quarterback. It has everything to do with the person who's calling the plays for those quarterbacks. And it's not crazy to me that Jalen Hurts, freshman year, he had such a fantastic year because the offensive coordinator, Lane Kiffin, believed in his skill set. Now Lane Kiffin leaves, you bring in an offensive coordinator who's an NFL guy and really wants an NFL type, NFL caliber, as he considers it, quarterback, and he doesn't jibe well. Now you go to this season, there's an offensive coordinator who believes in both quarterbacks, and when both of them come in, they essentially run the same stuff now. And if you look at Jalen Hurts, he's completing like 70-some-odd percent of his passes this year. So I think you see it a lot with how a quarterback is handled or managed depending upon who the offensive coordinator is and whether or not that offensive coordinator or head coach has a true belief in that quarterback.
No, I think that's an excellent point, and it's a great illustration of that point. Speaking of which, I mean, since we're, you know, you use that example of college football, who are some players you've been watching this year that you feel like should deserve more attention, or especially if you're, you know, a fan of the draft?
Okay, so I'm gonna first do the boring thing, which is go to a team that everybody's right. paying attention to, but maybe players that everyone's not on yet. Irv Smith is a beast. University of Alabama tight end. They keep tight ends. 2 years ago, I believe it is now in the draft that had O.J. Howard, and everybody knew how high I was on O.J. Howard. I thought he was the best tight end prospect in the past 10 years. I thought Gronkowski was one, and he was quickly going to become number two in the NFL. And I think he has done nothing to kill that notion. But at the time, I said that Alabama had three other guys who I believed had you know, top 30 pick, top 50 pick potential. Irv Smith is one of them. And now we're seeing that. He is so dynamic, and how they're able to use him like a legitimate tight end, but also take advantage of his skills as a receiver has helped to outside of just, you know, what Tua's doing, which has been ridiculous, has really catapulted this offense and made it almost impossible to stop, because you can't just key in on those deep throws down the middle or on the outside, because they'll drop it off to Irv and Irv will turn and go 30, 40, 50 yards with it. But he also isn't killing you in the run game because he's a legitimate blocker as well. He's a guy who I think should be tight end one on anybody's board, and really in contention if you see where the game is going and how the game is being played, as anywhere from a top 15 pick up.
Nice. So let me ask you this, because I was just kind of curious about this. He isn't any by chance the son of the former NFL tight end whose birthday is today, Irv Smith, of like the, you know, I don't know. I looked it up on Wikipedia just now because I was thinking about him, but I didn't see anything saying anything about his son or that, you know, but
I'm not positive if that's the case. I will say that Alabama does have a pretty good foothold into Texas, so it wouldn't be out of the range of possibility that is in fact the case. I'm not sure if that is, you know, his lineage, if he comes from NFL stock.
He's the son of former NFL Saints first round pick of the same name. So
well, then that makes a lot of sense.
And happy birthday, Irv Senior. If you're
happy birthday, Irv Senior. Guess what your son's buying you for a birthday? He's going to buy you a first round pick, because that's what he's going to be. He's going to try to beat where, do you know where Senior was picked?
He was a first round pick. So this, yeah.
No, I meant like, do you know which pick he was?
No, I don't, but let me see. I can look that up very quickly. So, because I was just there.
I am going to make a prediction that if people know what they're talking about in the NFL, Irv Smith Jr. or Irv Smith the second, whichever he is, will be picked higher than his father
Okay.
was, unless his father was a five pick.
His
Then
dad was round one, pick 20, out of Notre Dame to the Saints. So
I predict that his son will be a higher draft pick than him.
nice, nice. And Irv had a nice career.
And it reminds me of the Kellen Winslow Jr. thing. Now that you're saying his father, the only difference is Irv Smith is at a school where the buffoonery is not going to be tolerated. So I don't think he has an opportunity to get that swollen watermelon head. And also because there's a couple other guys behind him that are really good too.
Nice.
So this won't be the last you hear. Like, I think that Alabama is quickly staking a claim to having a tight end you kind of run.
Nice.
So
Nice.
that's a guy I really like, but it's a boring pick because it's from a team that's a powerhouse.
Sure.
A real under the radar guy I've been on for years now, is a quarterback at Lehigh, Brad Mays. He's a kid out of Tampa. Shouldn't call him a kid, he's a man now. But I followed his career at Berkeley Prep, where he was, a three sport athlete. Even though he's admittedly only really good at one, football, the kid had a live arm from an early age. He wasn't the biggest, he wasn't the fastest, but his accuracy and his arm strength allowed him to push the ball and get the ball to receivers. I was actually surprised because he committed to Lehigh pretty early, and I thought that a higher level school would come in at the 11th hour, 12th hour and make an offer, and they never did. And he ended up at Lehigh. He spent his first 2 years behind an incumbent, but he was so good that they couldn't keep him off the field. He had his first start as a quarterback. He threw for over 300 yards, five touchdowns. He's had a phenomenal career at Lehigh. This year, I don't think the team's doing as well. They lost a lot of weapons, and obviously, as a quarterback, you lose a lot of weapons. And now, especially in the college game, where you're trying to break in younger guys or guys who may just not be as good, because you can't just replenish a really good receiver at that level with a four-star recruit. That's just not what they're doing at Lehigh. So it's been a more trying time for him this year, but this is a kid that I could see getting a rookie tryout or signing as an undrafted free agent who can make a team. And very similar to he has a very Tony Romo-esque like game.
Okay.
And I think that he's someone that maybe a lot of people aren't on, and because you don't see him. And I always find it funny because Emory Hunt, our CEO of Football Game Plan, he's kind of the small school guy, and people are
Right.
always like, oh, well, I'm on this guy, and we always joke like, yo, Emory was on that guy like 3 years ago, and so
Right.
like, this is a guy who I think that. When the evaluation and the recruiting process, I mean, not recruiting process, excuse me, the draft process really starts to heat up, you're going to see him start to pop up on people's radars. And if you don't, just watch for him and see if he makes a team. Because I think if he gets an opportunity to get into a training camp, he's going to either make a team as a backup or as a get signed to a practice squad. And you can see him developmentally over a year or two, ending up as a either as a backup, you know, or as a legitimate shot to steal a starting quarterback position in the NFL.
Good, because I was hoping you were going to mention him after we were talking, after the podcast we did together this summer, and you mentioned him, and I was thinking, I'm hoping you're going to talk about him on this show, because I have, he's certainly on my list to watch of guys. I usually wait a little bit to watch quarterbacks, but I'm looking forward to that. So it's going to, yeah, that's a great pick.
Yeah, he's been good.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, he is. I mean, he definitely looks like he's a good one. So let's talk a little bit about NFL and then kind of round this out with our debate on Nick Chubb. But what have you noticed in the NFL that's just kind of caught your eye that, you know, in terms of players or schemes or teams that, you know, on either side of the ball that you found fascinating thus far within the first 6 weeks of the season?
Well, for me, I think that I don't know if I've always believed this or if this is just something that I'm just coming to an understanding of. There really are teams not trying to win in the NFL. I say this because I don't understand how they can't see what seems to be so blatantly obvious to me. And I could be wrong. I could be wrong, Matt. And if I am, cool. But how you look at the New York Jets and the defense and the weapons they have and say to yourself, I'm going to turn this over to a kid who is turnover prone and excitable but has talent when we have a legitimate shot to be a playoff contender is beyond me. I don't understand how the Jets turned their team over to Sam Darnold. I don't understand how the Bills run any of their organization. I don't understand how the Cardinals went into this year with a guy they knew would not stay healthy and seems to be really skittish in the pocket, and a rookie that people were questioning whether or not he even wanted to play the game. Like, are these teams trying to win? And I mentioned these teams, and especially in the Jets and Cardinals situation, because they both have defenses that are good enough if their offense could do anything on a regular consistent basis. The Jets had Teddy Bridgewater for practically nothing and showing that he could still play the game at a high level. He does what you're supposed to do because football is supposed to be the ultimate meritocracy. If you earn it, you get it. That's what we've been told. That's what we believe. That's why we love this game, Matt. And so for Teddy Bridgewater to have a preseason like he had, where he was virtually like perfect in what he was doing, to not earn that starting job simply because you have a rookie that you drafted that maybe, in my opinion, you shouldn't have drafted. You have a veteran that you paid way too much money for, who's always been a journeyman, and now you have a guy that you paid little to nothing. You don't have anything really guaranteed in, and you just let him go, and you hand him over to the New Orleans Saints. Like, was the Saints touched by Jesus? Like, what is going on? Like, the Saints are now set up for a succession that goes for another 15 years. Oh my God!
Very well, good.
Obviously, barring any type of injury. But I look at the Jets and I look at Arizona and the Bills. Oh, my God, what are you doing? And the Giants. We've been saying Eli Manning was done for years. You draft this dude, Saquon Barkley. You had a Geno Smith in pocket who could have been a good to serviceable starter for you, and Eli Manning hasn't even been a good to serviceable starter for you. So it, like, to me, there are clearly teams not trying to win, and I just don't understand that in a league where you can go from worst to first every year.
You know, it may be a provocative point to a lot of people, but I couldn't agree more when you look at all those ranges around. Now, you know, I would say I think Josh Rosen is going to be a good NFL quarterback, and I'm higher on him than some folks are. I understand the idea with Darnold and Bridgewater, because I was high on Bridgewater as well. And you look at what he did, and people go, well, I don't see the talent. Well, what you're not looking at is the decision-making, how he buys time in the pocket, how he finds those secondary windows, where he places the ball, the mature decision-making, you know, and you're looking at maybe things that are too highlight reel specific as opposed to actual nuts and bolts of how quarterbacks should be making good decisions and delivering and placing the football, you know, within the scheme and within certain situations where maybe the defense defends that scheme well and you have to create under difficult circumstances. And when you look at it from that frame, Teddy Bridgewater had an excellent preseason, and it is crazy to me. I mean, I just watched watching him go to the Saints, you're just thinking I'm happy for him, because you know, you want to see a player of his talent go to a team that wants him. You want him to go to a team that understands, especially when you look at Drew Brees and you look at the city and you think, you know, it was a team that took a chance on Drew Brees when he had a Pro Bowl season, and he got hurt, but you knew that A.J. Smith was chomping at the bit to get Phillip Rivers in there. There was no doubt, you know, that that was A.J. Smith's pick, and Phillip Rivers has had a good career by all means, and he was a good quarterback, but why did you make that decision? It was because you didn't believe in Drew Brees in the first place, you know, so now he's in, you know, for him to be in that, have the career that he did in New Orleans, and you're able to have a coaching staff that obviously is more open-minded in terms of how they look at talent and understand what talent is on a fuller spectrum than a lot of teams do. You know, I think that that's a big deal, but I mean, my only theory on that in terms of why teams do this is that it comes down to ownership. And I think ownership is like, you know, they're already in a socialistic system. When you think of, you know, every team has revenue sharing, nobody loses money. And so there's no incentive to win because you're not making money based on how well your team does. You know, everyone splits the licensing for game apparel. They like, you know, for all of those different things. So on some level, you know, the TV contracts, those are, I don't know if they split on game apparel, but I know on TV contracts they do. And if game apparel is something that isn't split, you could see where teams are like, well, let's, you know, the owner's thinking in a very myopic way. Let's draft a big name player that everybody on ESPN talks about and sell jerseys, you know, and fill seats and excite people. Let's excite people. You know, it's almost like that movie Draft Day where the guy who plays the owner, you know, in that is literally talking about it. And it's so, you know, it's so in your face in the way of like, we just want to fill the seats and do something exciting. We don't, you know, then I'm not even thinking about how we build a football team. I'm just thinking about it, you know, making a splash. Let's make a splash. And I think that I think that the people who wrote that were very smart in their sense of being able to say there's a grain of truth in that with some owners, because, you know, when you listen to people who've been in the league, they will talk about, they will talk about how, you know, if you're GM and you're trying to get a, you know, you're going to hire a coach and, you know, they go to the, you know, they end up going to the owner, and the owner's like, well, who do you have? And if the GM's going to say, well, there's this guy from Pittsburgh State who we really liked, who's doing some incredible work. And the guy's like, did you say Pittsburgh State? And he's like, no, Pittsburgh State. He goes, no, seriously, like, who are you going to hire? Because, you know, Colin Cowherd has us say that, you know, is saying this. And, you know, Lewis Riddick on ESPN is saying that. And, you know, and the guys on Fox are saying this. So, you know, who are these guys? Because you're not going to come at me and offer me a coach who may actually be, you know, have merit, unless they are also a big name that can make a splash. And I think that those are things that people just, they're dumbfounded when they hear those explanations, but they're real, you know? So yeah, to me, I'm with you. I think that I definitely agree that the Jets had more in the tank there. I mean, watching what the Jets did against the Broncos run game, this defense this week was pretty good. And I liked what they were doing offensively there. And there is defense is good enough. And you look at the Bills, you look at that. And I think that once they kind of transitioned to what Carolina and the old John Fox way of doing things, you know, last year, you could see that they just kind of abandoned what they were doing and wanted to change it over. And I'm totally with you about Sam Bradford. So yeah, that's fascinating stuff. Let's get into Nick Chubb. I mean, let's wrap this up with him. I mean, I think everybody who listens to this podcast knows I really am a very big fan of his game, and there's a lot that I like about it. But what is it about his game to you that you're looking at and you say, he's more just a guy to me? Like, he can play in the NFL, he can produce, but he's not a special talent to me.
Okay, so when I made the statement, my mentions blew up. People thought I was nuts, and that's what Browns fans do, because they just, anything that they see is positive, they're just going to take it to the nth degree. I don't dislike Nick Chubb as a running back. I just don't think that Nick Chubb can be your only running back. Like, I don't think Nick Chubb is going to produce at a level where you want to have him getting the ball 25 times a game. And my part of it comes from the way in which the NFL is run, or offenses are run now in the NFL. I don't think he offers you the same type of dynamics out of the backfield, which I'm okay with that, because I think that a running back should be able to run first. I do, however, find it more disheartening that he's always been a feast or famine kind of running back to me. Like, he'll break off a long run, and then there'll be some plays where he disappears for a while. My most damning thing for Nick Chubb to me is he feels like a big back that doesn't know he's big. And the times where you see him run big, it's almost by mistake. Not mistake, but just by surprise. Like, because he had no other choice. But whenever given the choice, he always seems to choose the avoidance route or the let me try to make someone miss, which he's just not as good at as other backs are, i.e. a Sony Michel, who I think is really good in a phone booth. So it's like, I love his explosion. I love his breakaway. I think he does a decent job at finding holes, but I don't think he's otherworldly. Outside of that run that he had, that second long run that he had for the Browns, when I look at every carry that he's had in the NFL, I see opportunity for more yards that he has not taken advantage of. It's not like he's running into a stone wall, and the guys in front of him, the guys who are getting more carries, seem to be finding the holes that he does not seem to find. It is something that I've actually had to possibly reconsider with my with me liking Ronald Jones as a back for the Bucks, because I at some point I have to say, well, darn, he's getting these same carries. He's not producing and finding these holes the same way that a Peyton Barber is. Maybe it's him. Maybe it's not anything else. Maybe I'm overthinking it. I need to go back to Occam's razor. And that's kind of where I am with Nick Chubb. It's like, when you bring in the NFL, if you have Nick Chubb as your, like, a first down, second down, or a couple carries here in the first quarter, and then I switch it up with another guy, I think that's the best way. I think that using another guy and then coming in with the Nick Chubb, is a great way. And you see the Browns starting to try to do that more. But if I take those two big runs away, those two, like, ridiculous runs that he had for the Browns away, his production is nil in the NFL, and I can't get away from that. And it's the same thing that I think about when I look at their final season at Georgia, and Nick Chubb and Sony Michel had very similar statistics, but Sony Michel had far fewer carries. And that over a full yard per carry more average for Sony Michel is something I can't get by when I look at those two and compare who should be a feature back and who should probably be a complementary back. And so for me, I think that's why I look at Chubb and I say, hey, you know, Chubb is probably a complementary back. The very same way that I look at Latavius Murray and think that Latavius Murray is a complementary back, not necessarily a 25 carry a game type of guy.
Okay. So that's interesting because it's like, it's funny because where you and I are at, in terms of like how we see his work between the tackles, you know, it's interesting to me because, I mean, obviously I have a lot of respect for how you look at the game and how you see the game, but this is a player that I think you and I probably couldn't even be more far apart on in terms of between the tackles. Because it's, you know, when I look at how I saw him as a tremendous decision maker who took what was there in situations where it wouldn't have made sense to bounce a play outside. It wouldn't have made sense to try and do more than just kind of push through or push a pile. I thought that he was a guy that did a tremendous job of displaying contact balance and not just on breakaway runs, but also the ability to even, you know, he does have that niftiness with footwork, but I thought he was a guy who really showed a strong display of eyes to feet, understanding of where his blocks were setting up and how to really take advantage of that. I mean, on a level that I saw him as, I thought he was a better decision maker than Saquon Barkley. I thought he had better judgment. I thought he was in that realm of guys like Gurley and Ezekiel Elliott in that level. And so, you know, and what was fascinating to me is while unfortunately I can't name and I feel like this doesn't make my argument a very good one, Gene, because I'm going to have to say, you're going to have to trust me on this. But, you know, the one, it was an interesting argument. You know, watching him at Georgia, I felt like he was the better inside runner. I thought now they used both those. I think Michelle's an excellent running back, and I think that he's definitely in the same tier. But I thought that Chubb was a little bit better of like an inside zone runner. And it was interesting to me that a particular reporter that we both know, and I'll tell you after the show, but I don't want to reveal it because he asked the guy on the record a question about who played on that line, you know, who was the better inside zone runner in that backfield. And the guy said, I'm not going to answer that for you. And then he asked after the interview, he said, do you mind me asking you just off the record? And he said, yeah. And he said, Nick Chubb, you know, so it was kind of interesting, you know, on that level, because those are kind of some of the things I saw. I just don't think that, I think this team is trying to get its money out of Hyde. I think that they feel more comfortable with trying to have Duke Johnson as a pass protector, which I find kind of interesting because I think he misses a lot of blocks. I don't think he's a very good I don't think he's a very good pass protector at all. And if they want to use him, I can see why Johnson's kind of being vocal about saying, put me in as a receiver, use me as a slot option, use me more in that way. I like catching the ball. I can help this team that way. And they could use a guy who can do more of that. And so I thought Chubb was a good pass protector who, yeah, he made a mistake. You know, he's had so few touches thus far that I find it kind of hard to make an assessment of him in the actual regular season. And in the preseason, I felt, you know, I broke down his game in pretty much good in a lot of detail, showing a lot of plays where there was maybe one play that I saw, and obviously maybe there's things I didn't see that you did, but things where I felt like he only got frustrated like in that Giants game. I mean, I felt like he got frustrated early in the second half and tried to bounce a play where he shouldn't have and be more evasive, where I thought there were a lot of plays where he took what was there. And even though they were minimal plays in terms of output, I thought the process was very sound. And so I don't know, this is fun, because this could be a good thing for maybe you and I at some point. We could get together and watch some Chubb tape and see where that is. Because when someone who I respect with, you know, your eye and understanding the game sees a player that I probably watched him more than any player and came away, you know, because of the knee injury and things like that, and came away really impressed to a degree that was probably much higher than most folks. It'd be fun as a learning experience to get a chance to watch him together and see where that is, because that helps me as an evaluator, and it's a good exercise. So,
and I will say this: I think that Hyde and Chubb is a redundancy.
Right.
I don't think that they need Hyde and Chubb. I don't understand why you get Hyde and then draft Chubb.
Right.
I don't understand that whole thought process in the first place. I think sometimes, like in when you have to break down or you have to evaluate, it comes down to whatever that person's eye is, and we're talking nuance.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
Like, we're not, neither one of us, like, I'm not saying that he's Barry Franks. You're not saying he's Barry Sanders.
Right.
But the difference for me is when I look at, and if you look at it, if we try to put this into into some people who are not like diehard football heads, like we're geeks, like we're nerds,
right?
When it comes to football, because that's what we do, is what we like to do. Put a highlight package on for Sony Michel. Put a highlight package on for Nick Chubb. It strikes me that a highlight package for Nick Chubb will feature a lot of plays of him bouncing. Very similar to Saquon Barkley, by the way, where you put a highlight film on for Saquon Barkley and it shows a lot of bounce, plays where he bounces. Times where he doesn't necessarily need to bounce. And so when I do that and then I put on a Sony Michel, I see a lot more where there's the opportunity to bounce and there's a cutback lane that he hits instead. And for me, what that says is that when both options are present, Barkley and, in my opinion, Chubb will take that opportunity to bounce, whereas Michelle might take that opportunity to cut back.
Interesting.
Is one worse than the other? Not necessarily, except for in the NFL, the guy who bounces normally gets run down, because in the NFL, defenses are ridiculously athletic. So, like for me, I think that's why you saw a lot of the struggles from Barkley early, which, if you then, because you're a football head, actually dig deeper into the film, you see that there's a lot better decision making that Barkley makes that may not be the highlight reel plays that make you comfortable with him as running back one in the draft. And the same thing with Chubb. But, you know, in times of fight or flight, what does somebody resort back to? Is in times of fight or flight, or quick decision making, or, you know, split decision making, excuse me, they're going to do what they feel most comfortable with doing. And in my opinion, those two backs feel more comfortable going east and west to get their extra yardages. Very similar to Henry for Tennessee.
Yeah.
Because he's humongous, and I wonder why he ever bounces things, and he always tries to bounce something, because in times of crisis, that's where his brain goes first. I think it's something that you can improve on throughout time, and I expect all three of those backs to improve on it. But at the end of the day, that's who they are. I think of another back, Brandon Jacobs, who's huge and big and strong and athletic, but was never really a pounder like people wanted him to be. That just wasn't his game. He just happened to be a big back, but not necessarily a pounder. LeGarrette Blount, another example of a guy who, while he gets good plays between the tackles, if he gets an opportunity to bounce that thing, he's going to bounce it.
Yeah, I mean, a good example of a guy who guys who corrected that were LeSean McCoy and Jamal Charles. Those were guys
very good, very good. Because and really in LeSean McCoy and Jamal Charles's situation, I believe it wasn't until they started to see the physical wear that bouncing it and taking those hits was taking that they said, man, you know, the quickest the line between, you know, me and the touchdown is best if I go straight. Someone who didn't do that very well, Chris Johnson, is why he was probably a comet, you know, instead of a star.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's what I look at.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. You know, I mean, and I think that's going to be fun to see how this plays out over time. Hopefully we'll get enough carries from him over the course of time to see, you know, kind of see the merits of what we're both each talking about with him and get a chance to examine a little bit more on NFL tape. But, I don't understand
why he's not getting more carries. Like, I don't quite get that. That doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, Carlos Hyde, you're not – that's six in one hand, half dozen in the other, in my opinion, except for with Chubb, when he gets into the open field and he gets a chance to get that turnover going, you're not catching that dude.
Right. Yeah, people don't understand. And that's kind of a funny thing about him, because people don't understand that probably the back that – you know, a scout I know kind of said this about him and saying that, you know, if you think about, like, just from the metric standpoint, he very much resembles what Jonathan Stewart was coming out of school before all the injuries were there.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking at a 230-pound back with great, you know, and that's not far off from when you think about Saquon Barkley as well. I just thought, you know, where we're different is just the nuance of, you know, how we see their decision making, you know, and those are things that I know I still disagree with that based on what I've watched, but I want to go back now and think about that more and see if there's something I missed with some of the points that you mentioned there. So, you know, listen, this was a great conversation. We got a lot of things, you got a lot of fun insights and a lot of helpful insights that I think are going to be worthwhile for people to chew on here. Gene, where can people follow you and see more of your work?
And people can follow me on all social media platforms at Gene Clemens. Whenever I drop articles, you'll find me posting them there. At footballgameplan.com, our football game plan YouTube channel. I have a Best Bets pod if you're somebody into sports betting. Best Bets pods that I do with Emery and Chris James that we record on Wednesdays. They normally pop up on Thursdays right in time for your football fixings. My Offensive Interference podcast, which I don't do enough of, but I should have a new one here dropping in the next couple days. You can check that out. And stay tuned. I've got a project that I'm working on right now called 100 Days of College. And it's really something that I'm doing that's going to be done at the beginning of the year next year, where every day I'm going to do like a 5-minute review of colleges that a lot of people haven't heard of. And I'm doing it twofold. One, just because I love colleges and the idea of the university and the college system. But two, for awareness for my students and any young man and woman who just think, as I did when I was growing up in a poor, impoverished neighborhood, that the only colleges and universities that existed were the ones that I saw on television. And so really giving an opportunity to highlight the colleges and the universities that many people have never heard of. Because for every University of Georgia, there's a University of West Georgia that many people have never heard of outside of the state of Georgia.
Right.
You know, for every Alabama, there's a North Alabama, you know, that no one's heard of outside of that area of Alabama. And so I really want to take an initiative to show that, you know, give some light to those colleges and universities and show these young men and women, especially young men and women who are athletes, that their life isn't over if they don't get a Division I offer from Alabama or Florida or Florida State, that West Florida is out there and West and North Alabama is out there and Valdosta State is out there. And so I'm really passionate. And right now I'm reaching out to admissions offices to try to, you know, get some, get t-shirts from various smaller school admission officers. And my hope is to every morning record a 5-minute video with me with the t-shirt on and talking about the schools and the various sports that are offered, their best majors, and then opportunity to get more information on those schools.
Awesome. No, that's an awesome idea. And I think that, you know, again, as someone who is a teacher and someone who works with youth, it's, you know, it's just a great opportunity for kids to learn a little bit more and to be able to give back in a way that I think is, you know, in terms of information. And that's just fantastic. So listen, you know, this was a fantastic podcast. You can check out Gene, you know, at Gene Clemons on Twitter. You can check him out at Football Game Plan, which I highly recommend the work that Gene, Chris, and Emery do. And of course, you know, you can follow me at Matt Waldman. If this is the first time you've heard this podcast. I also do a publication that's a draft publication called the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. Usually has about 150 to 170 skill players every year in it. I have a process that's laid out that's pretty detailed that you can see how I grade players down to, you know, the specific techniques that I look for and how I define it. You know, I've been doing this for 14 years. And it's a publication where 10% of every sale goes to Darkness to Light, which is an organization that trains civic groups and educational groups and police officers and, you know, fire department and teachers, how to prevent sexual abuse of children and how to identify, you know, potential predators, how to be able to deal with situations when abuse does happen and how to keep it from being making the situation worse so that you can help protect the children in those cases. And we've been able to train, you know, at this point for the past several years, I'd say we've been able to train in the thousands now with what we've been able to donate from the Rookie Scouting Portfolio each year. So definitely check that out at mattwaldmanrsp.com. And on behalf of Gene and I, thanks again. You guys have a good weekend.